1.2 million Americans have now been canceled by their insurance companies.
Canceled your show.
And Futurama's been canceled.
Canceled.
Canceled too soon.
Is officially canceled.
Be canceled twice. His launch pre-order bundle was canceled. Do we know it's a his?
Have been effectively canceled.
And abruptly canceled.
From Target is canceled.
Or unceremoniously canceled.
The plan was being canceled.
The cabal has been canceled.
Look at the role of the Rothschild family.
Money and power.
Monsanto and a few other chemical companies.
Culling the population through eugenics is their answer.
The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization.
These are the most disgusting people on the face of this earth.
Or they control the information.
The powerful few people who run this planet,
they're not as powerful as you think.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Now brings you Cancel the Cabal.
Red or blue?
Okay, welcome everyone to another Cancel the Cabal on Shake and Wake Radio and PSN Radio and SoFlo Radio. And I do want to say right off the beginning that all the stations are listener supported, so please help out if you can. It's only getting rougher and rougher on me and Annie and everybody else. As I asked last week, and everybody said they wanted me to read this book, it's The Truth About Contagion, Exploring Theories of How Disease Spreads by Dr. Tom Cowan and Sally Fallon Morrell. I'm going to read the preface, and that's by Sally Fallon Morrell. This is going to be a shorter book, that's for sure. It's only 100 and... I think I looked at it just a few minutes ago. 160, maybe not even 160. Yeah, like 160, 162, somewhere in there. Gonna be a lot shorter book, that's for sure. Yes, it's. He spaced all of his sentences and lines normally like somebody should, so it's probably only like 100 of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s book. Probably only like 100 pages of his. Preface by Sally Fallon Morrell. Since the dawn of the human race, medicine men and physicians have wondered about the cause of disease, especially what we call contagion. Numerous people become ill with similar symptoms all at the same time. Does mankind suffer these outbreaks at the hands of angry God or evil spirit? A disturbance in the atmosphere? A miasma? Do we catch the illness from others or from some outside influence? With the invention of the microscope in 1670 and the discovery of bacteria, doctors had a new candidate to blame: tiny one-celled organisms that humans could pass from one to another through contact and exhalation. But the germ theory of disease did not take hold until 200 years later, with celebrity scientist Louis Pasteur, and soon became the explanation of all four most illnesses. Recognition of nutrition deficiencies as a cure of disease like scurvy, pellagra, and beriberi. Took decades because the germ theory became the explanation for everything that ails the human being. As Robert R. Williams, one of the discoverers of thiamine, vitamin B1, lamented, all young physicians were so imbued with the ideas of infection that the cause of disease, that is, I guess I should ask, I forgot to ask, sound levels okay? All young physicians were so imbued with the idea of infection as the cause of disease that it presently came to be accepted as most axiomatic that disease should have no other cause other than microbes. The preoccupation of physicians with infection as a cause of disease was doubtless responsible for many digressions from attention to food as the causal factor of beriberi. All right, thank you. During the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918, the deadliest example of a contagion in recent history, doctors struggled to explain the worldwide reach of the illness. Yeah, that's because they didn't know about radio waves and microwaves back then. It sickened an estimated 500 million. And this is a virtually brand new book. It hadn't been opened either, so the pages are crisp and tightly held to each other. What did I say? 500 million? I thought that's what I said. Yes, 500 million people. About one-third of the planet's population, and killed between 20 to 50 million people. It seemed to appear spontaneously in different parts of the world, striking the young and healthy, including many American servicemen. Some communities shut down schools, businesses, and theaters. People were ordered to wear masks and refrain from shaking hands to stop the contagion. Sounds familiar. But was it contagious? Health officials in those days believed that the cause of the Spanish flu was a microorganism called Pfeiffer's baculus, and they were interested in the question of how the organism could spread so quickly. To answer the question, doctors from the U.S. Public Health Service tried to infect 100 healthy volunteers between the ages of 18 and 25 by collecting mucus secretions from the nose, throats, and upper respiratory tracts of those who were sick. They transferred these secretions to the noses, the mouths, and the lungs of volunteers, but not one of them succumbed. Blood of sick donors was injected into the blood of the volunteers, but they remained stubbornly healthy. Finally, they instructed those afflicted to breathe and cough over the healthy volunteers. But the results were the same. The Spanish flu was not contagious, and physicians could attach no blame to the accused bacterium. Pasteur believed that the healthy human body was sterile and became sick only when invaded by bacteria. A view that dominated the practice of medicine for over a century. In later years, we have witnessed a complete reversal of the reigning medical paradigm. That bacteria attack us and make us sick. We have learned that the digestive tract of a healthy person contains up to 6 pounds of bacteria. Wow. Which play many beneficial roles. They protect us against toxins, support the immune system, help digest our food, create vitamins, and even produce feel-good chemicals. Bacteria that coat the skin and line the vaginal tract play equally protective roles. These discoveries call into question many current medical practices, from antibiotics to hand washing. Indeed, researchers have become increasingly frustrated that their attempts to prove that bacteria make us sick, except for coactors in extremely unnatural conditions. Enter viruses. Louis Pasteur did not find a bacterium that could cause rabies, and speculated about the pathogen too small for detection by microscopes. The first images of these tiny particles, about 1/1000th of the size of a cell, were obtained upon the invention of the electron microscope in 1931. These viruses, from the Latin virus for toxin, were immediately assumed to be dangerous infectious agents. A virus is not a living organism that can reproduce on its own, but a collection of proteins and snippets of DNA or RNA enclosed in a membrane. Since they are seen in and around living cells, researchers assume that viruses replicate only inside the living cells of an organism. The belief is that these ubiquitous viruses can infect all types of life forms, from animals and plants to microorganisms, including bacteria and archaea. A-R-C-H-A-E-A. Archaea. Not sure. Difficult to separate and purify viruses are a convenient scapegoat for diseases that don't find the bacterial model. Colds, flus, and pneumonia, once considered exclusively bacterial diseases, are now often blamed on a virus. Well, this particular virus. Allegedly a virus. It is possible that scientists will one day discover that these particles, like the once maligned bacteria, play a beneficial role. Indeed, scientists have already done just that. But old ideas, especially ideas that promise profits from drugs and vaccines, the one bug, one drug mentality die hard. Today, the premise that coronavirus is contagious and can cause disease has provoked the justification of putting entire nations on lockdown, destroying the global economy, and throwing hundreds of thousands of out of work. But is it contagious? Can one person give coronavirus to another and make them sick? Or is it something else? Some outside influence causing illness in the vulnerable? These questions are bound to make public health officials uncomfortable, even angry, because the whole thrust of modern medicine derives from the premise that microorganisms, cause disease. From antibiotics to vaccines, from face masks to social distancing, most people submit willingly to such measures in order to protect themselves and others. To question the underlying principle of contagion is to question the foundation of medical care. So be it. That was my input, not his. Or hers, I'm sorry. This is the preface still. I am delighted to join my colleague Tom Cowan in creating this expose of the modern medical myth that microorganisms cause disease and that these diseases can be spread from one person to another through coughs, sneezes, kisses, and hugs. Like Tom, I am no stranger to controversial views. In my book, Nourishing Tradition, first published in 1996, I proposed the heretical idea that cholesterol and saturated animal fats are not villains, but essential components of the diet, necessary for normal growth, mental and physical well-being, and the prevention of disease. In Nourishing Traditions and in other writings, I presented the radical notion that pasteurization, collateral damage of the germ that, the germ theory destroys the goodness of in milk, and that raw whole milk is both safe and therapeutic, especially important for growing children. It is the most obvious substitute for breast milk when mothers are having trouble nursing their babies, a proposition that makes health officials squirm. In subsequent publications, I have argued the dissenting view that it is a nutrient-dense diet and not the administration of vaccines that best protect our children from illness. Over the years, these views have found increasingly support with both laypeople and health professionals. Error has consequences. The result of the notion that our diets should be devoid of animal fats, that children should grow up in a processed skim milk, and that it's fine to vaccinate them dozens of times before the age of five has resulted in immense suffering in our children, an epidemic of chronic illness in adults, and serious decline in the quality of our food supply. There are economic consequences as well, including the devastation of rural life and small farms, especially dairy farms prohibited from selling their milk directly to customers, give in against the price pressures of big agricultural corporate farming. The parents of children with chronic illness, estimated to be as high as one child in six, struggle with the cost of caring for them. What are the possible consequences of the premise that microorganisms, especially viruses, cause disease? The coronavirus pandemic gives us many clues: forced vaccinations, microchipping, prescribed social distancing, lockdown, mandatory masks, and negation of our right to assemble and practice our religion whenever an illness appears that can be media hyped into a public health emergency. Yes, closing churches down and keeping the bars open and liquor stores and the marijuana dispensaries. They're good. Churches are bad. Again, that was me, not her. Until we base our public policies on the truth, the situation will only get worse. The truth, that is, truth is that contagion is a myth. We need to look elsewhere for the cause of disease. Only when we do so will we create a world of freedom, prosperity, and good health. Sally Fallon Morrell, July 2020. Introduction by Thomas S. Cowan, M.D. I am no stranger to controversial views, particularly controversial positions in the field of medicine. In my latest series of three books, I have denounced several sacred icons that form the basis of our attitudes toward disease and its treatment. In Human Heart, Cosmic Heart, I clearly demonstrate that the heart is not a pump, and that blocked arteries are not the predominant cause of heart attacks. Then in Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illnesses, I propose the theory that acute illness is not caused by an infection that attacks us from the outside, but rather represents a cleansing of our watery cellular gels. Colorally, I don't even know what that word, I've never seen that word. Corollary. Must be another Dr. Snob word, scientific word. A corollary to this position is that any intervention that interferes with this cleansing response, in particular vaccines, is bound to create untold harm that manifests in skyrocketing rates of chronic disease. Corollary. Never seen that word. Corollary. Did Moon Girl pop in yet? I hadn't seen her. In what I thought would be my third and final book, Cancer and the New Biology of Water, I show why the war on cancer is an utter failure. I argue that the modern chemotherapeutic approach to cancer is useless, and that an entirely new way of looking at this problem must emerge. I postulated that this new way of looking at medicine and biology must put the question of what actually causes disease squarely in the forefront of our thinking. I thought I was done with writing controversial books, at least about medicine, and that I could turn my attention to finishing out my career as a practicing physician, spending more time in the garden, and creating a healing place for myself, my friends, and my family. I knew that I would continue doing occasional interviews and maybe some online classes or mentoring. I would still talk about the nature of water and the increasing pollution of our earth. But I would also hope that interest in my work would wane and simply become part of the generation consciousness. The general consciousness. A new way of thinking that would change our attitude toward disease and rehumanize the practice of medicine. I did have a nagging thought which had been there for years, as I needed to delve into HIV/AIDS affair, but I was content to let that be. It was more likely an itch that only occasionally begged to be scratched. Not long ago, I had lunch with a homeopathic physician, and we were joking about our respective long careers in medicine and how much things have changed over the years. For some reason, the conversation turned to immunology, and we asked each other what we remembered learning in the medical school about immunology. That was back in the early 1980s. We both jokingly concluded that the only thing we remembered was being taught that if you wanted to know whether a patient was immune to a particular viral disease, you could test antibody levels. If the antibodies were high, that meant they were immune. Just as people remember for the rest of their lives the moment they heard JFK was shot and about the World Trade Center towers coming down in September 11th, I have a vivid memory of hearing the announcement that Robert Gallo in 1984 that they had found the cause of AIDS. It was caused by a virus called HIV. And the reason they knew it caused AIDS is that they found elevated antibodies levels in some, not all AIDS patients. In some AIDS patients, but not all. I remember turning to a fellow medical student at the time and saying, "Hey, who changed the rules?" In other words, after having spent the previous 4 years learning that people with antibodies to a virus were immune to that particular virus, we were now being told with no explanation whatsoever that antibodies meant that the virus was actually causing the disease. I didn't buy it then, and I don't buy it now. For more than 35 years, I have read countless articles, books, papers, and documents about the lack of connection between HIV and AIDS. This naturally led more to investigate the connection between viruses and other diseases, and what I discovered was shocking, to say the least, that the background of my now famous 10-minute video about the cause of the coronavirus pandemic. Even though I have been awake for decades that the virus king is naked, I was hoping the others would take up the challenge to relay this information to the general public. But a 10-minute video thrust me into the stage. It happened like this. In early 2020, I received an invitation to speak at the health conference in Arizona. I knew almost nothing about the group that invited me, but they gave me a first-class airplane ticket. So I agreed. I wasn't clear on what the topic they wanted me to speak on, but since I never spoke with slides or notes, I figured I would improvise with usual, interestingly. I would improvise as usual, interestingly, a few times in the weeks leading up to this event. My wife asked me where I was going, to whom I was speaking, and what the subject was. I just shrugged, and she said, seemed like nice, earnest people. A few weeks earlier, the whole coronavirus event started to dominate the news. At first, I didn't think much about it, figuring that this was just another in a long line of viral scares. Remember SARS, MERS, avian flu, Ebola, swine flu, and Zika. These were going to kill us all, but then just faded away. Alrighty, mark my spot here, and take the first break. Well, let's see. I think about a 5-minute song. A little over 5 minutes, everyone, so be right back.
You could see what I once was if you could go with me back to where I started from. Then I know you would see a miracle of love. And made me what I am today.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. Going to continue on. But with coronavirus, things started to intensify, particularly the dramatic, draconian responses by the authorities. Still, I didn't think much about it, although I did wonder whether the illnesses were the initial consequence of the planned 5G rollout, or perhaps a cover-up for the rollout, or perhaps just an excuse for the rollout. That's what I added, sorry. I thought about skipping the conference in Arizona, mostly because I was afraid of being quarantined there and not allowed to return home. I decided I was being paranoid and that I might as well honor my agreement to speak. When I arrived at the conference, I discovered that there were only 20 or 30 attendees. The three other speakers had all canceled or decided to do their talks via Skype or Zoom. I was scheduled to do one talk each day of the two-day conference. The first day's talk was on acute illness and vaccines, my usual stump speech on the subject. With a talk on heart disease on the second day. That night, we started to hear more about quarantines and grounded planes, given the sparse attendance. I spent part of that first night online to see whether I could catch an earlier flight home and then skip my second talk. I slept fitfully, worried about the weather. I should catch the 7 a.m. flight instead of my scheduled 1 p.m. flight. I decided that was crazy, and as long as I was there, I would do my talk on the heart, and maybe end with a few comments about viruses and the current situation. To say I didn't know I was being taped is not accurate, as I obviously wore a microphone, and the guy in the back of the room seemed to be filming me. At least some of the time, but in my mind, I was clearly speaking to the group of 20 or 30 people. At the end of the talk, I made a few off-the-cuff remarks about why viruses do not cause illness. I said my piece and left for the airport. I was one of 10 or so people on the plane, and I made it safely home. Very glad to be there. A few days later, I got an email from Josh Coleman, the guy who filmed the video, saying he had posted my remarks on viruses somewhere online, and it was getting a huge response. I thought this might be interesting, but not much more. The rest, as they say, is history. I have no idea how widely circulated that 10-minute video was, has become, or how many people have seen it. Josh tells me that it has had more than 1 million views. I only knew that I needed to speak more about this subject, even if only to clarify what I had said at the conference. Interest in my comments come from people all over the world. Overnight, I had become the point person for an alternate view of viruses, the germ theory, the current health situation, and a lot more. This led to a few podcast interviews, including one with Sayer G on greenmedinfo.com and my own webinars. Of course, I was criticized and even received some shocking threats, but I have also received support in ways I could never have imagined. I mean no harm to anyone. I am one man with a certain perspective. Hopefully correct in some ways, and if incorrect in other ways. I ask my readers only to understand that any errors come of a place of seeking the truth and my ability to understand the situation. Two things press me forward. The first is to make it possible for all of us to live in a world where everyone can speak their minds and hearts freely without fear of recrimination or abuse. What could possibly be wrong with having an open and honest debate about the nature and cause of illness and disease? This is a complex question, and no one person or group has all the answers. But isn't that what real science is? Opposed to scientism is supposed to be about but isn't that what real science as opposed to scientism okay I get it now is supposed to be about? I had to read that again, sorry. It didn't make any sense. Second, I am concerned that if my understanding of the current situation is even close to correct, an understanding for which we intend to make a clear and convincing case in these pages, then humanity is at a crossroads right now. There will be profound, even unimaginable, consequences for all life on Earth if we fail to heed the messages that emerge from the current situation. My contention is that if we fail to understand the true causes of the coronavirus pandemic, we will go down a bitter path from which there will be no turning back. But is that what, that is what is driving me to write this book. I am happy to be writing this book with fellow iconoclast Sally Fallon Morrell. Sally and I have been friends, collaborators. This is our third book together, and I dare say spiritual partners for over two decades. With a small contribution from me, Sally founded the Weston A. Price Foundation in 1999. Perhaps the single best resource available to bring a truth in food, medicine, and farming to a world starving for that truth. I sincerely wish that this to be the last book Sally and I work on together. We have enjoyed collaborating, but I expect that the current pandemic of humanity, the current pandemic we are living through will be a profound turning point in the history of humanity. It is my hope that out of this event, a new way of life will emerge in a world free of poisoned food, poisoned water, and the poisonous and false germ theory. In this world, I envision no need for Sally and myself to write books. People will just know how to live, and they will know what to poison. And they will know that to poison their food, water, air, and the electric sheath of the earth is something only madmen can contemplate. We both look forward to the day that we can forget about warning people about this and that and spend more time growing and cooking food and sharing it in joy and laughter with our families, friends, and neighbors. No more books after this, dear friends. We will know all you need to know. Buckle up, folks. We are in for the ride of our lives. Thomas S. Cowan, MD, July 2020. Chapter 1, Exposing the Germ Theory. Contagion. Let's get right to the nitty-gritty of this issue, contagion. How do we know whether any set of symptoms has an infectious cause? As we can all imagine, I hope this doesn't get technical and scientific. Oh, I got tired of the other two technical and scientific books. Oh, I got tired of it. As we can all imagine, determining the cause of disease in general, or a set of symptoms in any particular person, can be a complex and difficult task. Obviously, there are many factors to be considered for any one person, or at any one time in his life or her life. Are the symptoms a regular of genetics, poisoning, bad diet, nutrient deficiencies, stress, EMFs, negative emotions, placebo or non-placebo effects, non-SIBO, I guess that's non-placebo, non-SIBO effects, or infection from another person by a bacteria or virus. In finding our way through this morass, we need well-defined rules to determine how to prove causation. And these rules should be clear, simple, and correct. We do have such rules, but scientists have ignored them for years. Unfortunately, failure to follow these guidelines threatens to destroy the fabric of society. Imagine that an inventor calls you up and says, he has interviewed a new ping pong ball, invented a new ping pong ball that is able to knock down brick walls and therefore make the process of demolition much easier and safer for builders and carpenters. Sounds interesting, although it is hard to imagine how a ping pong ball could do such a thing. You ask the inventor to show you how he has determined that the new ping pong balls are able to destroy brick walls. His company sends a video. The video shows them putting a ping pong ball in a bucket of rocks and ice cubes, and then take the bucket and fling it at a small brick wall. The wall goes down. There's the proof, they say. Wait a minute. How do we know that it was the ping pong ball that knocked the wall down and not the rocks and ice cubes that were also in the bucket? Good question. The inventor replies and then sends a video showing the animated or virtual ping pong ball destroying the virtual brick wall. He lets you know that the ball and the wall are exact renditions of the actual ball and brick. Still, something doesn't seem right. After all, it's fairly easy to create a computer image or video that shows such an occurrence. Yet we would all agree it has nothing to do with what might happen if the actual ball and wall, with the actual ball and wall. The inventor is getting exasperated with all your questions, but since you are a potential investor and he is interested in having your financial support, he persists. He then sends you a detailed analysis of what makes his ping pong ball special. It was special protrusions on the outside of the ball that grab onto and destroy the integrity of the cement building. Of the cement holding the bricks together. Also, they built a lightweight internal system in the ping pong ball that, according to the inventor, leverages the power of the ball, making it hundreds of times more powerful than the actual ping pong ball. This, he says, is absolute proof that the new ball can whack down walls. And he's not being laughed at yet? I think I would be. At this point, you are ready to hang up on this lunatic. But then he pulls the final trump card. He sends you videos of esteemed researchers in the new field of ping pong ball demolition. They, of course, have been funded entirely by the Ping Pong Ball Demolition Council and have attained prestigious positions in this field. They each separately give testimony that the interesting qualities of this new ping pong ball, they admire that more research is needed, but they have presumptive evidence that the claims of improved efficiency are correct and that a cautious investment is warranted. At that point, you do hang up on the phone and check outside to see whether you've been dropped into Alice's Wonderland and whether you have been talking to the Mad Hatter. Now, if this ping pong ball can really knock down brick walls, the obvious thing to do is to make the ping pong ball throw it, is to take the ping pong ball, throw it at the wall, and record what happens. Then they have multiple non-invested people to do the same and make sure the company didn't pour lead in the ball and throw it at a wall made of paper bricks. We could call this the ultimate ping pong ball test. UPPBT. He's got an acronym for that. Well, it's his scenario. He can make it up however he wants to. His story. As bizarre and crazy as it sounds, this lack of evidence that a microorganism called coronavirus pulls down the wall of your immune system, invades your cells, and starts replicating in them. It's exactly what has happened with the coronavirus pandemic. No one has bothered to see what happens if you do the, what is that again? Ultimate ping pong ball test. UPPBT. Throwing the ball up against the wall. If you even suggest that we should do this, the trolls emerge from the shadows to call you crazy person, spreading fake news. Most people would agree. I'm going to take a 10-second break and get something to drink. Got a little bit of a dry throat. Of course, I'm kind of choking. Because I still haven't figured out how to breathe and drink at the same time. Somebody learns that. Can you please tell me how to do that?
Yeah.
Cough, cough, gulp. Where am I at? Okay. Most people would agree with the requirement of providing that the ping pong ball can destroy the brick wall. It's not something any of us would consider negotiable. And most people would agree that seeing a real brick wall demolished by a ping pong ball constitutes proof. In other words, sane, rational human beings would accept the above UPPBT as true and relevant. Heinrich Hermann Robert Koch, 1843 to 1910, is considered the one of the founders of modern bacteriology. He created and improved laboratory technologies that isolated bacteria and also developed techniques for photographing bacteria. His research led to the creation of the Koch's postulates, a kind of UPPBT for disease, which consists of four principles linking specific microorganisms to specific diseases. Koch's postulates are as follows. Number one, the microorganism must be found in abundance in all organisms suffering from the disease, but not found in healthy organisms. Number two, the microorganism must be isolated from a disease organism and grown in a pure culture. Number three, the cultured microorganism should cause disease when introduced into a healthy organism. Number four, the microorganism must be re-isolated from the new diseased experimental host, which received the inoculation of the microorganisms and identified as identical to the original specific causative agent. And all four conditions are met, if all four conditions are met, you have proven the infectious cause of a specific set of symptoms. This is the only way to prove causation. Interestingly, even Koch could not find proof of contagion using his postulates. He abandoned the requirement of the first postulate when he discovered carriers of cholera and typhoid fever who did not get sick. In fact, bacteriologists and virologists today believe that Koch's sensible and logical postulates have been recognized as largely obsolete by epidemiologists since the 1950s. Yeah, because they work. That's why they found them obsolete, because they work. And that goes against the narrative, goes against the official policy. comrade. Koch's postulates are for bacteria, not for viruses, which are about 1,000th times smaller. In the late 19th century, the first evidence of the existence of any tiny particles came from experiments with filters that had pores small enough to retain bacteria and let particles through. In 1937, Thomas Rivers modified Koch's postulates in order to determine the infectious nature of viruses. Rivers' postulates are as follows. Number one, the virus can be isolated from diseased hosts. Number two, the virus can be cultivated in host cells. Number three, proof of filterability. The virus can be filtered from a medium that also contains bacteria. The filtered virus will produce a comparable disease that the cultivated virus is used to infect experimental animals. Number five, the virus can be re-isolated from the infected experimental animal. Number six, a specific immune response to the virus can be detected. And time for the first hour break. Mark my spot. Oh, let's see here. I guess about a six minute break. Be right back after the break, everyone.
Lost in sin, but Jesus took me in.
Did you scare the puppy with your singing, Annie? Ran off the chair? You cleared the room. You should sing solo. Solo, nobody can hear it. Just teasing, Annie. I should sing solo, too. Solo, then nobody can hear it. Please note that Rivers drops Coke's first postulate. That's because many people suffering from viral illness do not harbor the offending microorganism. Even with Coke's first postulate missing, researchers have been able to prove that a specific virus causes a specific disease. Using Rivers' postulates, one study claims that Rivers' postulates have been met for SARS, said to be a viral disease. But careful examination of this paper demonstrates that none of the postulates have been satisfied. Again, this book's central claim is that no disease attributed to bacteria or viruses has met all of Koch's postulates or all of Rivers' criteria. This is not because the postulates are incorrect or obsolete. In fact, they are entirely logical. but rather because bacteria and viruses don't cause diseases. At least none in any way that we currently understand. How did this state of error come about, especially concerning infections? With bacteria and viruses, it goes back a long time, even to philosophies exposed in ancient Greece. Several philosophers and medics promoted this theory during the Renaissance, but in modern times, this masquerade became the explanation for most disease, with that great fraud and plagiarist, Louis Pasteur, father of the germ theory. Imagine a case in which some people who drink the milk from a certain cow developed profuse, bloody diarrhea. Your job is to find the cause of the problem. You wonder whether there is a transmissible agent in the milk that is being consumed by the unfortunate people, which makes them ill. This seems perfectly reasonable thus far. You then examine the milk under a newly invented microscope apparatus and find a bacterium in the milk. You can tell by its appearance that it is different from the usual bacteria that are found in all milk. We carefully examine the fact. You carefully examine the milk, discover that most, if not all, of the people with bloody diarrhea, in fact, did drink this milk. You then examine the milk consumed by people who didn't develop diarrhea, and find that none of the milk samples contain this particular bacterium. You name the bacterium Listeria, after a fellow scientist. Then, to wrap up the case, you purify the bacteria so that nothing else from the milk remains. You give this purified bacteria culture to a person who then develops bloody diarrhea. The clincher is that you then find the same bacteria in their stool. Case closed. Infection proven. Pasteur did this type of experiment for 40 years. He found sick people claimed to have isolated a bacterium, gave the pure culture to animals, often by injecting it into their brains, and made them sick. As a result, he became the celebrity scientist of his time, feted by kings and prime ministers and hailed as a great scientist. His work led to pasteurization, a technique responsible for destroying the integrity and health-giving properties of milk. His experiments ushered in a germ theory of disease, and for over a century, this radical new theory has dominated not only the practice of Western medicine, but also our culture and economic life. We are proposing a different way of understanding the milk study. For example, what if the milk came from cows that were being poisoned or starved? Maybe they were dipped in flea poison. Maybe they were fed grains sprayed with arsenic instead of our natural diet of grass. Maybe they were fed distillery water and cardboard, a common practice in Pasteur's day in many cities around the world. Distillery water, huh? We now know with certainty that any toxins fed to the nursing mammal show up in her milk. What if these Listeria bacteria are not the cause of anything, but simply nature's way of digesting and disposing of toxins? After all, this seems to be the role that bacteria play in biological life. If you put stinky stuff in your compost pile, the bacteria feed on the stuff and proliferate. No rational person would claim the compost pile has an infection. In fact, what the bacteria do in the compost pile is more of a bioremediation, or consider a pond that has become a dumping ground for poisons. The algae see the poison and digest it, returning the pond to a healthier state, as long as you stop poisoning the pond. Again, this is bioremediation, not infection. If you take aerobic bacteria that need oxygen, and put them in an anaerobic environment in which their oxygen level is reduced, they often reduce poisons. Clostridia is a family of bacteria that under healthy circumstances ferments carbohydrates in the lower bowel to produce important compounds like butyric acid, but under anaerobic conditions, this bacteria produces poisons that can cause botulism. It's the poisons, not the bacteria itself, that make people sick, or more fundamentally, it's environmental or terrain that cause the bacteria to create the poisons. That's made more sense in a lot of stuff. A lot of scientific stuff. I'm glad he kind of broke that down simply. Isn't it possible that toxins in the milk, possibly because the cow is not well nourished and cannot easily get rid of the toxins, account for the presence of Listeria, which is always present in our bodies, along with billions of other bacteria and particles called viruses? The Listeria is simply biodegrading the toxins that proliferate due to an unhealthy condition of the milk. The central question then is, how can we prove that the Listeria and not something toxic in the milk is causing the diarrhea? The answer is the same as in the ping pong ball example. Feeding a healthy person the milk is like throwing the bucket with stones, ice, and yes, a ping pong ball at the wall. It proves nothing. You must isolate the ball, in this case, the listeria, and feed only this to the healthy person or animal to see what happens. This is what Pasteur claims to have done in his papers. Pasteur passed his laboratory notebooks along to his heirs with the provision that they never made the notebooks public. You proved something, but no, we can't see what you did. And we can't see how you did it. That's nice. That's just nice. However, his grandson, Louis Pasteur Vallée-Rédeau, who apparently didn't care for Pasteur much, donated the notebooks to the French National Library, which published them. In 1995, Professor Gerald Gayson of Princeton University published an analysis of these notebooks, which revealed that Pasteur had committed massive fraud in all of his studies. For instance, when he said that he injected virulent anthrax spores vaccinated and unvaccinated animals, he could trumpet the fact that the unvaccinated animals died. But that was because he also injected the unvaccinated animals with poisons. Yeah, that's why he didn't want nobody to see his notebooks. In the notebooks, Pasteur states unequivocally that he was unable to transfer disease with a pure culture of bacteria. He obviously wasn't able to purify viruses at that time. In fact, the only way he could transfer disease was to either insert the whole infected tissue into another animal. He would sometimes inject ground-up brains into the brain of another animal to prove contagion, or resort to any poisons to his culture, which he knew would only cause the symptoms of the recipients. He admitted that the whole effort to prove contagion was a failure, resulting in his reputed deathbed confession. The germ is nothing, the terrain is everything. In this case, terrain refers to the condition of the animal or person, and whether the animal or person has suffered from poisoning or starvation. Since Pasteur's day, no one has demonstrated experimentally the transmissibility of disease with pure cultures or bacteria or viruses. No one has bothered since Pasteur's time to throw a ping pong ball at a wall to see what happens. Incredibly, as that may seem, we are sitting on a house of cards that has resulted in incalculable harm to humanity and the biosphere and the geosphere of the Earth. In chapters 2 and 3, we will examine cases in which bacteria or viruses were falsely accused of causing disease. Read on, dear friends. The ride only started. That's because they still couldn't. They couldn't back then, and they still can't today, patent natural, unmodified food, whether it be fruits, vegetables, or whatever, or even dairy, chicken, or beef. They still can't patent that. And they can't make any money off of a cure. That's basically it. You can't make any money off of something that helps people.
Chapter 2, Electricity and Disease. And I'm going to try to take another drink here without choking. Yay, I did it. Chapter 2, Electricity and Disease. Well, Mark, I have a hiatal hernia. If no one knows what that is, that's my esophagus is constricted. And it's a little bit tighter than most normal esophaguses, so I get stuff that I get choked up on drinks and food. Nearly thought I wasn't going to make it a few times. Ended up one time having to cough very, very, or attempt to cough very hard to get an obstruction out. I was in a Mexican restaurant, and there wasn't a lot of people that, I don't know if they spoke English or not, but I wasn't about to not find out. So I took care of it myself. Give myself my own Heimlich. The earliest electricians were not technicians who installed wires in houses. They were physicians and healers who used the newly discovered phenomena of electric current and static electricity to treat people with ailments, from deafness to headaches to paralysis. The only problem with having patients touch Leyden's jar, that's what that was called, yeah, from the other book. What was that book? Electric Universe? Electric Rainbow? Leyden's jar, a device that stores a high voltage electric charge or subject themselves to electric currents, was that it sometimes caused harm and occasionally killed them. Yeah. That's how they got the electric chair. Later, a lot later, 250 years later, when Einstein did that to an elephant, right in front of a crowd of people, he electrocuted an elephant. One thing those early electrical experiments noted was that people showed a range of sensitivity to electricity. According to Alexander von Humboldt, a Russian scientist who, among other experiments, subjected himself and others to shocks of electric eels, it is observed that susceptibility to electrical irritation and electrical conductivity differs as much from one individual to another as the phenomena of living matter differ from those of dead matter. Oh boy, Annie. These early studies captured the imagination of researchers. They began to realize that electric currents ran through the bodies of frogs and humans, and that even plants were sensitive to electrical phenomena. After a 1749 earthquake in London, British physician William Stukeley concluded that electricity must play a role in earthquakes because the residents of London felt pain in their joints, rheumatism, sickness, headache, pain in their back, hysteric and nervous disorders. Exactly upon electrification, and to some of it, to some, it was proven fatal. As early as, well, you know, science has already proven that everything that exists has a electrical vibration to it, electrical force to it. As early as 1799, researchers puzzled over the cause of influenza, which appeared suddenly, often in diverse places at the same time. And could not be explained by contagion. In 1836, Heinrich Schwieck, I guess that's how it's pronounced, author of a book on influenza, noted that all physiological processes produce electricity, and theorized that an electrical disturbance of the atmosphere may prevent the body from discharging it. He repeated the then common belief that the accumulation of electricity in the body causes the symptoms of influenza. With the discovery of the sun's electrical nature, scientists have made some interesting observations. The period of 1645 to 1715 is when the astronomers call the Maunder minimum. When the sun was quiet, astronomers observed no sunspots during the time span, and the northern lights were non-existent. Aurora borealis. In 1715, the sunspots reappeared, as did the northern lights. Sunspot activity then increased, reaching a high in 1728. In 1728, the influenza appeared in waves on every continent. Sunspot activities became more violent until they peaked in 1738, when physicians reported flu in both man and animals, including dogs, horses, and birds, especially sparrows. By some estimates, 2 million people perished during the 10-year pandemic. Goodness gracious. All right, now I'm going to mark my spot right here, everyone. Take another break. The last break of the show. So, let's see here. I'll go with about a 7-minute song.
What it heaven gonna be like? I don't know about you, but when I think of heaven, I'm excited. Yes. Because I got property up there. Yes. My D-A-D-D-Y with Jesus. Been with Jesus for 32 years. My mama been with the Lord for 28 years. And man, one day we are all gonna be together one more time. Don't feel sorry for me, but got joy coming in the morning. And not only that, when I get to heaven, I'm gonna have me a brand new body. I'm not gonna walk with a limp. I'm not going to talk funny anymore. I'm going to walk and talk like Jesus. If you don't like the way I am, hang in there. I'm still in the oven. God's still in the kitchen. And God's still cooking on me. And when God get finished cooking on me, God going to pull me out of the oven, and God going to say, well done, good and faithful. Stop it. But when I think of heaven, when I think of my mom and my dad, when I think of a brand new body, George, I can tie my own shoes. I can button my own shirt. What a day. Glorious day. That will be. There is coming a day when no heartache shall come. No more clouds in the sky. No more tears to dim the eye. All in peace forevermore. On the happy golden shore. What a day. Glorious day. That will be. What a day. There will be no sorrow there, no more burden to bear, no more sickness, no pain, no party over there. And forever I will be with the song.
Okay, took me a few seconds to find my mouse here, but we're back for the not the last 20 some odd minutes. Guess I gotta put my glasses on. I won't be able to read. Get my Walmart readers. These and other facts about the relationship of influenza disturbances in electricity come from a remarkable book, The Invisible Rainbow by Arthur Furstenberg. That's what it was. The first book I read, for those who remember. Furstenberg chronicles the history of electricity in the United States and throughout the world, and the outbreaks of illness that accompanied each step toward greater electrification. The first stage involved the installation of telegraph lines in 1875. These formed a spiderweb over the earth totaling 700,000 miles with enough copper wire to encircle the globe almost 30 times. With it came a new disease called neurasthenia. I remember that word, neurasthenia. Like these suffering today from chronic fatigue syndrome, patients felt weak and exhausted and were unable to concentrate. They had headaches, dizziness, tinnitus, floaters in the eye. I've got a floater. Racing pulse, pains in the heart region, palpitations. They were depressed and had panic attacks. Dr. George Miller Beard and the medical community observed that the disease spread along the routes of railroads and telegraph lines, and it often resembled the common cold or influenza and commonly seized people in the prime of their life. Yes, thank you, Annie. In 1889, we marked the beginning of the modern electrical era and also of a deadly flu pandemic, which followed the advent of electricity throughout the globe. Said Furstenberg, influenza struck explosively and unpredictably over and over in waves until early 1894. It was as if something fundamental had changed in the atmosphere. It did. It was electrified. Physicians puzzled over influenza's capricious spread. For example, William Beveridge, author of the 1975 textbook on influenza, noted the English airship Arachne was cruising over the coast of Cuba without any contact with land. No less than 114 men out of the crew of 149 fell ill with influenza. And only later was it learned that there had been outbreaks in Cuba at the same time. During World War I, governments on both sides of the conflict installed antennas, which eventually blanketed the earth with strong radio signals. And during the latter part of the 1918 disaster struck, the Spanish flu afflicted a third of the world's population and killed about 50 million people. More than the Black Death of the 14th century. To stop the contagion, communities shut down the schools, businesses, and theaters. People were ordered to wear masks and refrain from shaking hands. Those living on military bases, which bristled with antenna, were the most vulnerable. A common symptom was bleeding from the nostrils, gums, ears, skin, stomach, intestines, uterus, kidneys, and brain. Many died of hemorrhage in the lungs, drowning in their own blood. Tests revealed a diseased ability, a decreased ability of the blood to coagulate. Those close to death often developed that particularly blue color which seemed to mark all early fatal cases. Health officials were desperate to find a cause. The team of physicians from the U.S. Public Health Service tried to infect their 100 healthy volunteers at a naval facility on Gallops Island in Boston Harbor. A sense of frustration pervades the report. Written by Milton J. Rosenau, M.D., and published in the Journal of American Medical Association. Rosenau had built a successful career in public health by instilling a fear of germs, overseeing quarantines, and warning the public about the dangers of raw milk. He believed that something called Pfeiffer bacillus was the cause. The researchers carefully extracted throat and nasal mucus and even lung material from cadavers and transferred it to the throats, respiratory tracts, and noses of volunteers. We used some billions of these organisms, according to our estimated counts, on each one of the volunteers, but none of them took sick, he said. Then he drew blood from those who were sick and injected it into 10 volunteers. None of them took sick in any way. Thoroughly perplexed, Rosenau and the other researchers designed the next experiment to imitate the natural way in which influenza... spreads. At least the way in which we believe influenza spreads. And I have no doubt it does, even through his experiments showed that it doesn't. By human contact, they instructed those afflicted to breathe and cough over volunteers. The volunteer was led to the bedside of the patient. He was introduced. He sat down alongside the bed of the patient. They shook hands, and by instructions, he got as close as he conveniently could, and they talked for 5 minutes. At the end of the 5 minutes, the patient breathed out as hard as he could, while the volunteer muzzled the muzzle in accordance with his instructions, about 2 inches between the two, received this expired breath, and at the same time was breathing in as the patient breathed out. This was repeated 5 times. The volunteers were watched carefully for 7 days, but alas, none of them took sick in any way. Perhaps, said Rosenau, there are factors or a factor in the transmission of influenza that we do not know. Perhaps if we have learned anything, it is that we are not quite sure what we know about the disease. Researchers even tried to inject healthy horses with the mucus secretions of horses with the flu. Yes, animals also became ill during the pandemic, but the results were the same. Spanish flu was not contagious, and the physicians could attach no blame to the accused bacterium, nor provide an explanation for its global reach. In the year 1957 marked the installation of radar worldwide. The Asian influenza pandemic began in February 1957 and lasted for a year. A decade later, the United States launched 28 satellites into the Van Allen belts as part of the initial Defense Communications Satellite Program, IDCSP, ushering in the Hong Kong flu pandemic, which began in July 1968. Right on cue. As Furstenberg observed, in each case in 1889, 1918, 1957, and 1968, the electrical envelope of the Earth was suddenly and profoundly disturbed. All along with it, the electrical circuits in the human body. Western medicine pays scant attention to the electrical nature of living things, plants, animals, and humans. But mountains of evidence indicate that faint currents govern everything that happens in the body to keep us alive and healthy. From the coagulation of the blood to energy production in the mitochondria, even to small amounts of copper in the bones, which create currents for the maintenance of bone structure. All can be influenced by the presence of electricity in the atmosphere, especially dirty electricity, characterized by many overlapping frequencies and jagged changes in frequency and voltage. Today, we know that each cell in the body has its own electrical grid, maintained by structured water inside the cell membrane. Cancer occurs when this structure breaks down, and cancer has increased with each new development of the electrification of the Earth. Humankind has lived for thousands of years with our brains tuned to the Schumann resonance of the Earth. Our bodies, and indeed all life, bathed in the static electrical field of 130 volts per meter. The electronic symphony that gives us life is soft and delicate, minute electrical currents that course through leaf veins or through the glial cells in our nervous system, guide the growth and metabolism of all life forms. Our cells communicate in whispers in the radio frequency range. Traditional Chinese medicine has long recognized the electrical nature of the human body and has developed a system to diffuse the accumulation of electricity that leads to disease. It's called acupuncture. Interesting. Many things that we do instinctively also help release any unhealthy buildup of current. The mother who strokes her infant's head or who scratches her children's back to put them to sleep, the caresses of lovers walking barefoot on the earth, massage even handshakes and hugs, all now discouraged by the frowny faces of health authorities. Fast forward to the internet and cell phone era. According to Furstenberg, the onset of cell phone service in 1996 resulted in greater levels of mortality in major cities like Los Angeles, New York, San Diego, and Boston. Over the years, wireless signals have multiple frequencies have filled the atmosphere to a greater and greater extent, along with mysterious outbreaks like SARS and MERS. Yeah, quite mysterious indeed. Nothing to see here, folks. Move along. Today, the quiet hum of life-giving current is infiltrated by a jangle of overlapping and jarring frequencies, from power lines to the fridge to the cell phone. It started with the telegraph and progressed to a worldwide electricity, then radar, then satellites, then that disrupt the ionosphere, then ubiquitous Wi-Fi. The most recent addition to this disturbing racket is fifth-generation wireless, 5G. 5G is a broadcast in a range of microwave frequencies, mostly 24 to 72 gigahertz, with a range of 700 to 2500 megahertz. Also considered 5G frequencies, in this range below the frequency of light are called non-ionizing, in contrast with ionizing radiation, which has a faster frequency than light. Higher frequency than light. Ionizing radiation, such as X-rays, cause electrons to split off atoms. Obviously, something to which exposure must be limited. This is why lead shield is put on patients when they get an X-ray. Instead of producing charged ions when passing through matter, non-ionizing electromagnetic radiation changes the rotational, vibrational, and electric valence configurations of molecules and atoms. This produces thermal effects, think microwave ovens. The telecommunications industry flatly denies any non-thermal effects on living tissue, even though a large body of research suggests considerable harm to the delicate electromagnetic systems of the human body from constant exposure to non-ionizing frequencies. In particular, high-frequency electromagnetics like 5G effect, cell membrane, permeability. Not a good thing when the architecture of a healthy cell ensures that it is not permeable except in controlled situations. We are already familiar with millimeter wave technology. This is a frequency of airport scanners which can see through your clothes. Children and pregnant women are not required to go through these scanners. A nod to potential dangers. Adults get zapped a second or two. 5G baths. 5G bathes us in the same kind of radiation 24/7. Of particular concern is the fact that some 5G transmitters broadcast a 60 gigahertz a frequency that is absorbed by oxygen, causing the oxygen molecule composed of two oxygen atoms to split apart, making it useless for respiration. Yes. On September 26, 2019, 5G wireless was turned on in Wuhan, China, and officially launched November 1, with a grid of about 10,000 5G base stations, more than exist in the entire United States, all concentrated in one city. A spike of COVID in cases occurred on February 13th, the same week that Wuhan turned on the 5G network for monitoring traffic. Illness has followed 5G installation in all major cities in America, starting with New York in the fall of 2019, in Manhattan, along with parts of Brooklyn, the Bronx, and Queens, all subsequent coronavirus hotspots, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Dallas, Cleveland, and Atlanta soon followed. With some 5,000 towns and cities now covered, citizens of the small county of San Marino, citizens of the small country of San Marino, the first country in the world to install 5G in September 2018, have had the largest exposure to 5G and the highest infection rate, four times higher than Italy, which deployed 5G in June 2019, and 27 times higher than Croatia, which has not deployed 5G in rural areas. The illness blamed on the coronavirus is slight to non-existent. Well, everyone, I think I'm going to stop right there. My back's giving me fits. So, I'll play a short song to end and thank everyone for coming out. Let's get a short song here. Well, medium song, about 4 minutes. See everyone next time.